In this week's lyric feature, Sunlight and Shadow, the story of composer Frederick May. The presenter is Maureen Garrett.
And I have often felt myself to be like a rock on the seashore that is covered over by the incoming tide every so often. But when the tide withdraws again, it is left once more desolate and forsaken.
The composer Frederick May talking in 1958 about his life as a composer. When I come into work every morning, I pass a head portrait of May, crafted by the sculptor Seamus Murphy, with a plaque underneath.
Frederick May was born in Dublin in 1911. He attended the Royal Irish Academy of Music in Dublin and obtained a BMus from Trinity College. He furthered his studies at the Royal College of Music in London under Ralph Vaughan Williams and Gordon Jacob.
But when you ask people today about their memories of Fred May...
We certainly couldn't communicate with him, the academic, a quartet and myself.
The composer John Kinsella. Gareth Brown had a lot of dealings with him when he published his string quartet in 1976.
Not very many people knew Freddie May. He was such a quiet, private little person. And so people actually didn't record or write down anything about Freddie.
He looked quite disturbed and old and poor.
Writer Colm Tobin met Fred May around the same time.
But he was literate and sour and opinionated. And his eyes would light up, so he was interesting.
You could say that his composition tailed off in his later years. I kind of lost touch with Fred. I think everybody did.
Composer Shosha Bodley.
And people did worry and wonder a bit about what had happened to him or where he ended up.
So where did he end up? Well, we know he spent time in Grange Gorman Mental Hospital and that for his last years he was in a hospital in Clontarf. When he died in 1985, he left no relatives that we know of. A small collection of works, including a string quartet, some songs and a half dozen symphonic works, and the sum of £3,000 left to Clatter Records, along with some papers and letters.
But that's Freddie's box. And that's Freddie's writing.
And where has it been all the time?
In Clatter. I just had it taken out because somebody's doing a book about Lugalore.
But if much of his later life was in shadow, his early life was full of sunshine. As a young boy, growing up with his parents and sister Sheila in a house in Marlborough Road in Dublin, happily going to his piano lessons.
The junior piano competition, with its 34 entries, was not as interesting as one was entitled to expect. There was a great deal of slack playing. But the player who stood out with distinction was Master Frederick May, a lad of great promise.
And even then, he was thinking of composing music. Here's Fred May himself, speaking in 1975.
I always felt from the age of about five that I would like to be a composer very much. And I remember having my first lessons in elementary harmony with Dr. Losh, and I thought that it was an absolutely wonderful thing if I could be a composer. I remember I used to ask him about Beethoven, and that admiration has lasted all my life because it seems to me that he was a real hero. I mean, his achievement, not only as a great composer, but as a great inspiration for all.
So, in fact, Fred May made plans to study in Austria. He had got a travelling studentship as a result of the success of his scherzo for orchestra. He was accepted as a student by Alban Berg, but it wasn't to be. Berg died in December 1935, and so he studied with Egon Veles instead. That time in Vienna during the Nazi era leading up to the Second World War was an experience that left its mark.
We are also privileged to meet Franz Lehár, who lives in Vienna and writes the music which delights us all. Vienna is perhaps best known as the City of Song, for in it so many of the great masters resided and composed their immortal music. Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert.
In uns selbst allein liegt die Zukunft des deutschen Volkes.
A few years later, Fred May wrote his work for baritone and orchestra called Songs from Prison. Words were by Ernst Toller, a Jewish socialist playwright who died by suicide in 1939. In this work, a political prisoner is comforted by the song of swallows just outside his cell.
I stand at night by the window bars. The swallow twitters.
After his time in Vienna, Freddie May returned home to Dublin and settled into the life of a freelance composer. He wrote his symphonic ballad, the more impressionistic Spring Nocturne, and the lyric movement for string orchestra, all against a background of his increasing struggle with deafness.
I always have composed in my head, I mean, and not at a piano. Of course, it's always advisable to have a piano close at hand to test what you've written, to see how it sounds, how it might sound to the public at large, and especially if one is a bit of a plodder like I am. Of course, people who have supreme genius like Mozart, the music flowed for them so naturally, so inevitably, in such a torrential flow that I'm certain that they were able to really to compose in their head. That is to say, they didn't need the intermediate stage of rough work on paper and so on. It just flowed naturally. Of course, that is a unique quality that only a very few people have ever possessed, and it seems to have more or less gone out of fashion.
He was, had the four great blessings in the Ireland of his day. One, he was a composer. Two, he was gay. Three, he was an alcoholic. And four, he was deaf. None of which got you very far in the Ireland of those days.
At some stage, though we can't pinpoint the date, he must have suffered a major mental crisis. The result was that he spent time in St. Brendan's Mental Hospital, more commonly known as Grange Gorman. We don't know how long he stayed there, possibly years. Maybe he would have stayed there for the rest of his life, except that his friend, Gareth Brown from Claddagh Records, had a promise to keep, to issue a recording of his string quartet.
But I didn't forget my promise to Freddie, and I said I'd find him, and I found it extraordinarily difficult. Nobody knew where he was, and nobody had seen him for a very long time. And eventually I discovered that he was in Grange Gorman. So I went up with my friend, who was a photographer, and we brought Freddie out of the asylum. He had not spoken to anybody for such a very long time. The next thing I did was to bring him to lunch in the Bailey, and he looked a bit desperate, although he was very much alive and aware and full of all his old intelligence. But he ordered an artichoke, and what I didn't anticipate was that he no longer remembered how to eat it. So that taught me a little lesson about being more careful. And slowly, he normalized, got used to seeing people, started to be able to talk. He didn't attend the recording in London. He didn't want to. He got invited by Dr. Hillary to Aurus Nocturon as a result of the recording, and came to life again.
So Freddie May came out of Grange Gorman. The string quartet recording was made and was hugely significant to him, his first and only LP. At some point in the mid-1970s, he was living in a flat in Dún Laoghaire and was often seen around his old haunts in Dublin.
My name is Colm Tobin. I'm a novelist, and I met Freddie May in the Stag's Head pub, and that encounter was something I always remembered. I used to go to the Stag's Head on a Saturday morning. I wouldn't have had a drink. I would have had maybe coffee and read the paper. I liked the windows. I liked the light. 1975, so I'm 20. It's probably the spring. And this old man starts annoying me. He's moving too close to me. He looks irritable and jerky. He's uneasy. And I really do want him to go away. And he gets closer and he starts to mutter. And eventually then he starts to talk. He's obviously terribly intelligent, and he wants me to buy him a drink, but he only wants a glass of Guinness. And he doesn't want anything else again. That's all he wants. And I realise what he mainly wants to do is talk. And Dublin in those years, that wasn't such an unusual idea, that fellows would be wandering around, almost out of Beckett, almost out of Flann O'Brien. Not tramps, but people in some way or other disturbed, old, and with various things to say, and slightly cranky. And one of the things he had to say was that he didn't know, this is 1975, that The Dark by John McGahern had been unbanned, which I suppose had happened really 10 years earlier or 8 or 9 years earlier. And I said, look, I have the book. And he said, oh, could he have a copy? He'd love to read it. And I thought, how strange that he didn't know this. But he had many sour things to say about various subjects. I said I would be back the following week at exactly the same place. He then went off. What happened was that we arranged to meet the following week at the same time, and I would bring a copy of the book, and I did. And he handed me something. And it was the Aeolian Quartet had made a recording, which was the first recording, as far as I know, the first LP of his string quartet. And he didn't tell me his name. I looked at the sleeve notes, they were by James Plunkett. I said, hold on, is this by you? He said, oh, you know, he didn't want to talk about that. I was terribly impressed.
When I wrote a string quartet, which has been getting a little bit of recognition lately, and that has made me very happy, but when I wrote it, I had the most terrific difficulty in getting a hearing at all, because there was no actively functioning Irish string quartet and no Irish record company. We had no Cleddar record people and people like that in those days, and I had such a run-around with this quartet that it was 12 years after it was written that it got a first performance at all.
He handed it to me sourly, not necessarily shyly, but with no, he didn't want any big fanfare of me going on too much about it. He didn't want me looking at it while he was there. He wanted to take it. But what was really odd was that he obviously didn't know many people to give it to. And anyway, I played it. I had a record player at home in the flat. And I really was very moved by it, especially by the last movement, by the way the sort of line of melody would come up. and then wander away and not resolve itself. And there was something terribly torn about it, almost in search of resolution.
Actually, Felix Abrahamian I brought along to the recording, who was the London Times music critic. And he said that if Freddie May came from any other European country, he would be a household name like Benjamin Britten would be in England amongst anybody who actually knew about or listened to music.
Fred was probably not his own best publicist, if you know what I mean. He regarded it as something that he did and something that was very important to him. But nonetheless, I don't know, I can't imagine him going out and publicising his own work. He would have found that probably difficult to do.
And I think if you look at Ireland in the 20th century and you ask, like, what were the great things made? But obviously we know what they are in the literary world, and I think we do know what they were in painting. But I think that string quartet stands out as an important piece of Irish beauty. That's there. There's a great sadness in it. I suppose all of the work produced in those years, really by anyone, tends to have that sort of jerky, melancholy, unsettled tone. But that does, and it's Irish. Of course, it's not Irish in any obvious way. He isn't including, say, any Irish tunes, or isn't like that. It's highly European. But of course, a lot of people thought maybe that you could be Irish and European. Not only in those years, but even today. And he was, therefore, a really central figure in the life of Ireland of the 20th century.
Oh, look, there's a letter.
Yes, this is lots of stuff.
Oh, he had lovely writing, didn't he?
I don't know what
any
of this is.
No, he's talking about, while waiting, I walked up as far as the Gaiety and got an RT programme from which I discovered that my string quartet is to be performed at the Wigmore Hall next Sunday evening at 8. If the audience liked the music, I thought it might stimulate if they knew Cladda had recorded it. I thought I'd let you know, but maybe it's too late to do anything about it now. Fred May.
Yeah, but she never did anything about that.
Yeah.
About that.
29th of April, 1975. Dear Mr. May, it gives me great pleasure to inform you that in recognition of your distinguished services to music in Ireland, An Corla Aileen has decided to award you an annual pension of £300 from Kish the Column Gill. Yours sincerely, Colm O'Brien, Director.
What happened then was that I kept my ears open in case anyone mentioned his name. And there was one time my friend Brendan O'Hare just casually told me a story that he was very late at night. They were all drinking in Martin O'Kine's house. And Freddie May was there. So I immediately started thinking, oh, right, Freddie May was there. And he was annoying Martin O'Kine. He was playing a tin whistle. He wouldn't stop. And whatever happened anyway, Martin O'Kine knew a taxi driver from the Aran Islands who would do anything for him. Gave him some money and said, this man needs to go to Belgrave Square where his father is. Now, his father won't want to let him in, but you must get him in that door. And this, they thought it was tremendously funny because the man who lived in this address was Ernest Blyde. Freddie May had been in the orchestra of the Abbey Theatre at a time when Ernest Blyde was the manager of the Abbey Theatre. And obviously you can imagine that you've lived in Vienna, you've written your string quartet, you've supped at the tilted table of Schoenberg and Berg and Webern, and now you're in Dublin and it's damp. And it's almost a closed city, and you're meant to be in the orchestra of the Abbey Theatre, which is not going through one of its heroic periods, as it were. And he was drinking, and I suppose the fact that he was homosexual might have mattered in this as well, and the fact that his hearing was going, and the fact that no one was playing his string quartet, that he wasn't a sort of famous artist in the city. But he had a dry wit, he had a sour wit. Even when I met him later on in 1975, he had a sour wit. And he would always say about Ernest de Blyde, I'll live to dance on that man's grave.
I think that I'm lucky at the moment. I'm not dead yet. I mean, not as far as I know. And we write to please other people, and the more people like it, the better I like it too.